Hello, Internet. This is David Rovics with another episode of Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in Belfast, 7 p.m. in Berlin. And it's one of several broadcasts I usually do every week. I do a discussion show called Discussions with David every Wednesday and Friday, and I host Fifth Estate Live, which has an actual producer, Peter Werby from Detroit, Michigan, longtime talk show host and member of the editorial collective of the board of Fifth Estate. And which is great, having an actual producer, because then I get to talk to people I don't already know, which is kind of the secret to my other show, is I'm interviewing my friends. And with this show, I get to interview people I haven't met yet, such as today, which has involved reading some amazing science fiction that I might not have come across otherwise if I hadn't been told what to do by the producer, which is why I like producers. And the show is also turned into a podcast, and you can also find it in podcast form on various platforms, including right there at the website at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the magazine, which the summer issue is out now. Includes an article by me and a fantastic cover by Seth Tobachman, among other things. if you're this week, I got a new album coming out, should be up on Bandcamp by this weekend. And if you want to know more about that, you can see the streaming I did over the course of the weekend, recording at a recording studio. I streamed the whole thing for anybody that is into that sort of level of geekiness. And with no further ado, I will now introduce to you a fantastic science fiction author, writer of short stories, and publisher of Obsolete Press and contributor to the Fifth Estate, Rich Dana, and from somewhere in rural Iowa. Where in rural Iowa are you, by the way? Is it a near a town that any of us heard of?
Oh, it's a secret location. I'm sorry. To divulge that. No,
those
actually
are the best locations.
Yeah. Not that anybody would want to track me down here necessarily, but for people who know, it's about 35 miles west of Iowa City, which is
the progressive hotbed of right. Iowa. Yeah, that's Iowa City. That's the place where you see like punk rockers hanging out on the streets and with mohawks and stuff. At least last time I was there. I don't know. Maybe it was a long time ago.
Yeah, well, that may have been a long time ago. But yeah, I'm sort of on the western front of the progressive territory for sure. A few miles further is Grinnell, home of Grinnell College, which is pretty famous for its progressive attitudes, but beyond that, yeah, it starts to get a little sketchy.
And I have to ask, in the progressive parts of Iowa, have you so far yet ever seen a Joe Biden lawn sign?
I can't say that I have, but you know, I don't get out a lot these days. You might be surprised to know.
Yeah, a lot of people don't, right? And writers tend not to get out so much. And then during the pandemic, writers really become hermits, right? It's like the invitation to a writer's retreat. Here you go, pandemic.
Yeah.
No, have you gotten a lot of writing done?
I've got a fair amount, although I'm currently obsessed with renovating a printing press. So that project's got me pretty well sidelined, but
you're renovating a printing press, and because you actually your skills involve there's some crossover in your skills. You have all sorts of technical skills as well as writer, which kind of lends you're sort of uniquely loaned to the idea of reconstructing a printing press. I mean, how old is the printing press?
It's as far as I can tell, it's from the mid-50s. 1950s. It's actually an offset press, a multi-lith press, which was
the crank that you turn.
This is a mechanical press. This is a fairly high-speed press. Although I have a love of Gestetner mimeograph machines as well. But this offset press is the same one that was favored by a lot of radical printers of the 60s, Black Panther Press, people like that, used these small offset presses. And although this one I recently found out was formerly used by a collective of women who published cookbooks, like church cookbooks. Great. So yeah, a whole different subculture there.
Technology that definitely has multiple uses in terms of, you know, whether it's used for good, ill, or something in between.
or Jell-O concoctions. Yeah.
Yes.
Definitely the work of Satan, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. Jell-O. Definitely invented by Satan. There's really no debate there.
True.
Being a science fiction writer and publisher and then choosing intentionally not to do that online, other than just to have a website where people can download PDFs, but like by the modern standard of online activity, that's basically like being a sort of the online version of a Luddite, right? The PDF. And I wonder, some people don't know that, but I'm pretty sure you're well aware of that. But, you know, but I wonder if you can talk about, I mean, I know that that also figures into a lot of your writing and the folks you're publishing. And incidentally, speaking of the publishing, I think what's right on your website is that you're looking for people who have things to contribute. And can you talk about the press and why it's not an online phenomenon to speak of?
Sure. I set out to do an old fashioned underground newspaper, which ironically enough, eventually led me to connect with Fifth Estate. And Fifth Estate was one of those underground newspapers that I was exposed to when I was a kid. This would have been 10 years ago, I guess, that I decided to commit to this. And it was just at the point where, you know, blogs and social media were really blowing up. And there's just such an overwhelming sameness to everything that comes at us through the screen, and that lack of tactile sensation, especially with those cheaply printed offset newspapers where your fingers would be black after you read them and you'd pass them along to another friend, and it was the physical, it's the same with zines, it's the physicality of the information exchange that happens, you know. You read it, you give it to a friend who reads it, and then it finds its way until somebody finally lines their cat box with it, and then it becomes compost. There's just something magical to me about ink on paper, and I wanted to get back to that. I named it Obsolete after an episode of The Twilight Zone, in which Burgess Meredith portrays a librarian who's deemed obsolete by the state because books have been banned. And so that's where the name Obsolete Press comes from. And it sort of, it definitely fits my thing. And then it's just been a progression of interesting interactions with people. I recently got access to the back shop of a small town newspaper in Grinnell. The owner was a friend of mine. And when she found out I was doing this sort of thing, she said, "Well, we don't print in the building anymore, but we have this printing stuff in the back that hasn't been used since 1993. Mm-hmm. And so we started restoring a hot lead linotype machine and the letterpress equipment, a Heidelberg press, and it's just been one thing after another after another, and I've just been completely consumed with obsolete printing equipment ever since. So
when you write, what do you write with?
It's a combination of things. I usually write in a notebook. Sometimes I'll type on a typewriter. Ultimately, I will edit on my laptop, just because, like everybody, spell check, you know?
Yeah, and it's very handy to be able to insert those. Yeah.
But
then in the end, there's something about the medium that has such an impact on the message as well, and on the type of communication that happens. I mean, I don't know, is it something inevitable about the way the internet works that all communication has to become so shouty and short form, and that we don't sort of read books or have some equivalent of book reading that goes on? At least maybe there is with webinars and whatever, I don't know, but it seems like there's something about that, you know. I don't know, what do you think? Is it the technology itself, or is it the way that the corporations have abducted it that makes it problematic?
You know, I was in early. I had an account on the Well. Do you know?
Oh yeah. Well? Yeah. Pre-internet. I remember the Well. Yeah.
Yeah. Pre-web for sure. It was dial up bulletin board out of the Bay Area. And yeah. It was pretty shouty back then too, even before
it was.
Web. It could be. There were trolls will be trolls, you know. But
I suppose the newspapers had their letters to the editor could be the same.
Yeah, it's different though. And you know, I've thought a lot about what you're talking about, and I have this sort of crackpot metaphysical science fictional theory about this, which is, at its root, binary information is always going to be ones or zeros, on or off. It's binary, and there, no matter how high def it is, at its root, it's either on or off. And there's something about the medium that lends itself to this extreme, you know, sort of interface between, it sort of forces people into extreme positions. And I don't know, as a musician, I don't know how you feel about digital versus analog recording, but for a long time there was like a graph that people passed around of an analog wave and then a digital signal, which is blocks. And there's like, there are these little pie shaped slices between the curve of the analog and those digital signals, that it's like, that's what's missing from an analog recording. I don't know if you've ever seen that depicted. I wish I had an illustration of that, but if you can imagine it. And there, I know a lot of recording engineers and other people who are like, that is kind of bullshit. But to me, it's kind of like, that's where that magic is, that little area of friction between the, you know, that sort of maybe area between the digital signal and the analog signal. I don't know. What do you think about that as a musician?
Well, I mean, I also, I kind of wonder more about the, before all the music started getting recorded in the first place. Like, I mean, I think there are important distinctions in all kinds of ways to be made between digital and analog, especially in terms of the ease of reproduction of the digital, which has, of course, led in many ways to the collapse of the music industry and to the collapse of the publishing industry, right?
Yeah.
But then what I also think about prior to all of this digital stuff was like, what was it like before we had records and phonographs and radio and even mass produced sheet music? But like, because I think I mean, I can't even imagine, and I don't know how well it's been documented, what kind of a seismic change the invention of radio and record players must have been. Because, I mean, we can see what it's doing in parts of the world where the introduction of these technologies is more recent, right? It's destroyed. Mm-hmm. It's destroyed folk music in towns, town after town that has... You know, folk music with a small F. You know, not white people from Chicago playing the guitar, but you know, real folk music, like world music, whatever you want to call it. You know, like they get together and listen to the radio in little villages in the Philippines. Now they don't sing together every night like they used to. This is what I've heard. I mean, it's secondhand information from anthropologists and stuff, but it sounds like it's been devastating. And I imagine in many ways the printing press had a similar impact on storytelling and on the subtle nature of changing the way stories could change and once it's printed and written down, then it's much more rigid.
Yeah, it's true, but there's a definite. I mean, technology is always. I mean, it's always about exploitation. It's about exploitation of resources. It's about exploitation of intellectual property, for lack of a better term. But there's something that happens in digital technology. I mean, in the days when we made cassette tapes off of LPs, and there was a certain amount of degradation of quality, and you might make a second or third generation cassette tape, and there was sort of this oral history of the transfer of that. And there was still a physicality of the, you write down the song list on your, you know, Memorex liner and you give it to your friend and
you hear the degradation of the second round of the copying, and whether you were using a tape player that was recently demagnetized or not.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And you know, the digital recording is exactly the same every time. It's, you know, it's punched out or theoretically it can be. And it's sort of turned into this monetized, it's monetized and yet it's devalued. You know, every MP3 is the same. You know, how many times do you flip through somebody's new record and then you have it, you possess it on your hard drive, but you don't go back and listen to it. You know, people have massive music collections and yet they don't listen to it. They're just pulling in more new stuff all the time. And there's a real difference between, you know, I've moved plenty of LP collections of record collector friends of mine. I mean, there is a physical presence to those recordings that, you know, is lacking in the digital realm. But that, you know, I think a lot about that sort of appropriation of folk music. I have a friend from Morocco whose family in Jujuka became famous when Brian Jones recorded them in the 60s. And it was kind of a big deal to use that. You know, their very unique cultural sound. And, you know, but now that has even, it used to be you had to wait for the master musicians of Jujuka to tour to hear them and to really experience that, or you had to go to Morocco and hear them play. Or there were these sort of field recordings that were out there, but there was still sort of a chain of physical connection all along the way, and that's really been broken, and now everything's just a YouTube video. You know, the guy in Scotland or the, you know, person in wherever, you know, in Central America.
The sort of over availability of everything in such high quality, sort of at least in terms of it, nothing is as high quality as the real thing if you're in Scotland or in Morocco, but basically in as high a quality as recorded form can offer, these things are just available in such abundance, right? And it's just people just get just the tendency is to just get lost and to sort of turn off, right? It's supposed to, you'd think it might be really engaging because you have access to so much information, but the actual impact is to disengage for so many.
Yeah. Nothing's internalized. Yeah.
So this, pandemic, this sort of like, I don't know. I mean, it often feels very apocalyptic. It feels like an apocalypse oftentimes because it's out here on the West Coast, when everything is literally on fire, at the same time as you have an out of control pandemic and you hear on the news that other parts of the world, such as within the same country, are underwater, you know, flooding, and then, you know, all the other things at the same time. But as a big fan of science fiction, mainly in the form of movies, although I when I was younger, I read more books, but sadly I don't actually read books or watch movies hardly at all anymore, except for occasional audiobooks while driving, which I haven't done either because I don't tour because of the pandemic. So I'm kind of lost without any devices, like internal devices. I love loads of devices, but no devices.
Yeah.
But this pandemic apocalypse is like, I mean, it's so much more interesting than any of the disaster movies I've seen. And there've been some really brilliant stuff, great writing, great research, great interesting new ideas. There's some great movies out there that have been made, but the real thing is like one of the things that with the exception of certain ones like Starship Troopers, which you mentioned in one of your articles, I believe, which is, I guess, a really Heinlein and the whole, I mean, this is, I want to talk about these different views among science fiction writers that goes way back, which you've also written about, like the sort of the political divide within the science fiction world. But none of them of any political orientation that I'm aware of have captured the complexity of the real apocalypse as well as the real thing. And you just wouldn't, if you made a lot of these details up, then people would inevitably accuse you of just going way overboard with it. I mean, you can't have a pandemic and massive fires and floods and a fascist in the White House all at the same time. That's just way too much material to work with. Yeah. It's, you know, it makes it too easy.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. Yeah, here in the Midwest, you know, here in Iowa, we were struck by something called a derecho, which I never heard of before, but it's an inland hurricane, essentially. And this part of the state had this sudden and massive windstorm that, like in Cedar Rapids, northeast of here, took out something like 60% of the tree canopy in the city. Over a billion pounds of tree waste has been taken to the landfill in the last month. I mean, wow. We did not even know this was a thing. You know, no. Tornadoes, Dorothy, you know, the barn blowing away. Yeah, sure. That happens every summer. But derecho, like, what the hell is this? Really still not anything like what you all have experienced in terms of the loss and the environmental, the ongoing environmental impact. I mean, this was very sudden, but still. Yeah, point taken. Truth is stranger than fiction. I look back at some things like J.G. Ballard's early work, The Drowned World and The Drought. And in one, the earth floods. In the other, the earth dries up and blows away. And we have both. You know, it's just amazing. And Ballard is one of those writers who really captures that sort of just people going on about their lives while the world is burning down around them and having domestic squabbles and worrying about their careers and these sorts of things. He had a real talent for that. But not many others have touched it. I recently reread E.M. Forster's The Machine Stops, which he wrote in 1909, which is actually in our anarcho SF anthology from Obsolete Press. It's pretty prescient. The isolation of people, the communicating solely through screens, this sort of overarching paranoia, it's kind of all in there. And this was written in the age of steam, you know? So,
yeah, actually I remember Zerzan, referring to that, story in, I think in a recent article somewhere, unless that was a very similar one, but it sounds like the same.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I still haven't read. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, Ursula K. Le Guin said something like, you know, science fiction's not about the future, it's about the present. And so the science fiction that we grew up on was usually about the period 20 years ago when it was written. You know, a lot of the stuff I read when I was a kid was very influenced by the A-bomb, and that sort of fear that, that people had, and the Red Scare and all that sort of stuff. So it's interesting to see what's coming out now. I just checked out Utopia, this new series from Amazon, I guess. And it's very of the moment, pretty interesting stuff.
Is it? Yeah. It's like a mini series kind of thing.
Yeah. I think it's a full series, you know. Who knows?
Right, but it's anymore. Called Utopia, right? On Amazon.
And there's a pandemic element to it. It's it's pretty interesting, pretty spot on.
And I mean the really one of the useful things about science fiction when you're writing about the present in actuality, it's so much commentary on the present, but you're doing it using all sorts of devices that allow the reader to not get caught up in the present day politics, which is, it's a powerful way to tell a story without the reader's, I mean, I wonder how often people actually have political conversions through the process of reading science fiction in either anarchist or fascist or other directions, because actually, there, as you point out in one of your articles, there's really quite, I mean, among science fiction writers, including well-known science fiction writers, their politics are all over the map.
Yeah, that's for sure. And some of them personally, their politics are all over the map. I mean, Heinlein started out as basically a socialist or a populist, at least a sort of labor populist, and ended up kind of, I guess, in the what we now call the sort of libertarian camp. And you know, there's a lot of libertarianism that's run through science fiction. A lot of people point to Ayn Rand. I don't consider her a science fiction writer, and she certainly wasn't an anarchist. You know, the so-called anarcho-capitalists, sort of worship her. Unfortunately, she was kind of a horrible writer and sort of a horrible person, but she's one that people point to all the time as having been super influential. I mean, she had one good book, and it was kind of a ripoff of somebody else's book. So, But in terms of being all over the map, yeah, you know, there's been a battle in one of the great things about science fiction is that from its start, the fans have been very involved in the creation of science fiction. The advent of fanzines and the ability to self-publish really, they in a lot of ways, they were the fans of science fiction were the first to really embrace that technology and run with it. And then a lot of those young fans grew up to be writers. And from the very beginning, there was a big schism. And kind of the way in the art movements of the time, like Dada and Futurism, you know, there was a sort of a fascist element to Futurism, their worship of high-speed industry and, you know, all of this. And, of course, being rooted in Italy and at the time they were, whereas Dada was very much a response to, you know, the hell that everyone had experienced in World War One, and there was sort of an anarchist element to them. In fandom, there were leftists and then these sort of what they called the technocrats. You know, they were sort of believed in better living through chemistry, you know, better living through science. And we still have that now as sort of this techno-utopian vein and then a very sort of earth-oriented side to science fiction. So yeah, it's that battle has been going on since the, you know, the first Worldcon in New York City in the 30s, and it's still being played out in the science fiction community today. Very interesting.
It is. And one of the, one of the top five most iconic, influential science fiction phenomena of the past of my lifetime, I guess I would be fair to say would be Star Trek. And it's been so interesting to see the debate around Star Trek in political circles, because I mean it's generally painted as a progressive phenomenon and generally loved by progressives because it's depicting a society where there's no money and there's no hunger, and you know, everybody's out exploring the universe and doing it in a very sort of, you know, sort of a way that appeals to sort of constitutionalists or something. I mean, with the Prime Directive, and they're trying not to mess things up, and it's a very friendly United Nations kind of attitude. Like, but and then there's at the same time, they're all ranked and hierarchical and following each other's orders, and it's all a very militarized society at the same time, as they're not using guns with bullets that make people bleed, you know, but they die anyway. You know, they shoot each other with other things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Star Trek, you know, Star Trek was a huge influence on me when I was a kid. My first major outing on my own when I was 13 was to go to the Chicago 1975 Star Trek convention. And it was just a huge thing for me. And as a latchkey kid growing up at that time, you know, with a dad who was not in the household, you know, those male role models were my, you know, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy were the three parts of sort of the, you know, the male role model. But yeah, and Zerzan has a great piece, Why I Hate Star Trek, I think it's called. It's just, I think that's the title. And he talks about how the first series had that sort of Horatio Hornblower naval hierarchical thing going on. And then when it came back as the Next Generation, it had more of a corporate structure. There's very HR sort of aspect to Picard, you know, how Picard managed his crew. It was no longer this sort of I'm the captain and you do what I say. It's sort of this whole, you know, let's form a committee and, you know, and this sort of thing. But truly the best of all the Star Trek series, as far as I'm concerned, was Deep Space Nine, which because it was at a crappy outpost that nobody wanted. And it was a bunch of losers that got thrown there and a bunch of marginalized aliens who still did believe in money. And it was just, it's like, yeah, even when we've all been raised to this level where, you know, we don't dirty our hands with these things, somebody's still cleaning the toilets, you know? And there's actually a kind of a great book called Trekonomics. I can't remember the economist who wrote it, but he does a real serious breakdown of the economics behind the Star Trek universe. Is very, very interesting.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And I have to ask about my the science fiction that I happened to come across, which I thought was, when I discovered this director, I've just been blown away by everything they've been doing. I don't remember the guy's name, but you know, District 9 and Elysium. Mm-hmm. I thought when I first heard about the plot of District 9, which basically is, you know, set in recently nominally post-apartheid South Africa, and alien refugees from another planet sort of end up getting stuck there, and then things play out. And I just thought the plot line seemed so obvious in a way. Like, I just thought, oh, this is going to suck, but I just had to see it anyway because it was such a politically charged kind of plot line. And then I just thought, wow, this was done just so well. It was I thought it was amazing. As I also thought the same of Elysium in terms of painting a picture of how dystopia could potentially be transformed. I wonder what your thoughts are on those movies.
Yeah, absolutely. And District 9 was one of those movies that sort of also opened people's eyes to the fact that it's like, wow, there's some pretty good science fiction coming out of other parts of the world besides the United States, both. And, you know, that's been borne out both in film and in literature in the last few years. So, yeah, I was really, really glad that movie was as good as it was and that people embraced it the way they did. There are a lot of great science fiction filmmakers making little shorts. I mean, this is one of the great things about YouTube and, you know, the ability to do this sort of thing. But also, you know, people from South America and Africa making short science fiction films and posting them online, and some great, great stuff. You know, it's really wonderful to,
the technology for creating CGI and all this kind of stuff, is it all becoming more accessible and less of an elite phenomenon now? Is that why there's more of it coming out, or is it something about the internet that's lending itself to this? Because one other thing I hear about because of my nephew who does animation is a lot of this collaboration, collabs, I guess, is a new word for me, but I'm sure it's been around a long time, but collabs between animators making each one doing like 10 seconds and then putting together an entire film that way.
Yeah. That's definitely a thing, but there's a lot of great stuff coming out with no CGI whatsoever, or practical effects, or, you know, very, very low tech kind of stuff, but just great storytelling, and storytelling that's based in narrative traditions other than those that we're accustomed to in this part of the world. So yeah, I would encourage people to, when you're down the YouTube hole sometime to poke around in those corners and see what kind of stuff is out there.
What are some good places to look?
Oh gosh, I wish I had written some of this stuff down. I should put together a watch list. A friend of mine and I did a Thursday night film festival of Japanese classic sci-fi and monster movies this summer, and we're tooling up to do an international series next, and he's just been blowing me away with the stuff that he's been sending me. So
have you seen Shin Godzilla?
I haven't, no.
Oh my goodness. I was so hoping you had seen it. It's one of the best movies I've ever seen. I want to talk to you about it after you see it. But I mean, it is like the most brilliant commentary on Fukushima and on the incompetence of the state.
Yeah.
Most of the movie happens inside a boardroom with a bunch of, sort of Japanese bureaucrats talking about what they're going to do about the fact that a monster is destroying their country, meanwhile, the monster is destroying the country and, you're just like, you're in the boardroom again. I mean, it is just an amazing movie.
Yeah. I've heard about it. I got to check it out. I don't claim to be a big expert on kaiju movies, but the head of film studies here is, and oh my God, we learned a lot about the history of Japanese monster movies on Thursday nights this summer. It was really fun.
Anybody who has not read, this is incidentally, the Fifth Estate is published online to some extent. It's mainly a print thing, but sometimes bits of it are put online in some semi-readable form. Your short story, science fiction story, Grid Interactive on the Longest Day of the Year is just phenomenal, and people can find it if they look online at fifthestate.org. But I was just like, the economy of words and the way you communicate such a powerful bunch of imagery and tell a really powerful story in just a few hundred words. Can you talk about that, using words with such economy? And one of the things that occurs to me as I was reading that is just like, even just like the title, how coming up with a title and which title you come up with, and how the title, which as people may or may not know who are involved in some way with publishing, but so often somebody writes a book and they are not the ones who actually come up with the title of the book. That's often, maybe they have some role in vetoing a bad title, but sometimes they don't. And, it's the publisher comes up with the title, which just seems like a horrible thing to me, because when I think about it, the title, there's a book, Primo Levi wrote a book about his experiences in Auschwitz. And he originally called the book If This Be a Man. And then it was the publisher, without his permission, retitled the book Surviving Auschwitz.
Wow.
Which is, completely different, and it colors the whole thing. As you're reading it, I realized when I thought about it, I thought, if I had known the original title, it would have been such a more, even more deeper exploration of the human psyche than what it was, anyway, we talk about writing and using words like with that kind of economy.
Well, thanks. I'm so pleased that you enjoyed that story. It's one of my favorite. I was really excited when Fifth Estate decided to run some science fiction, and it was mine. My father was an English professor and a quite accomplished poet. I think I inherited the economy of words from him. His ability to create a story on a page with a handful of words was quite astounding. He was also really gifted in that he could teach other people to do that. He's really remembered as being an exceptional teacher of creative writing. And so I had this guy like proofreading my papers when I was a kid, you know, and he just, with the nicest of intention, just called bullshit on a lot of stuff. And he would just be like, you don't need all that. You know, you have one sentence here and the rest is extra, you know? I really got that from him. And like I told you, I think my sort of attention deficit disorder personality lends itself to flash fiction. I've written longer stuff, but my really short stuff I think is the best. And although I'm primarily a nonfiction writer, once in a while it really clicks in. And in the case of Grid Interactive, I think that's one of those cases where I really was sort of hitting on all cylinders for sure.
Mm-hmm. Do you write poetry yourself?
I don't. No, I mean, occasionally, and not for publication, but no, that's not something that he passed down. That gene was not passed down for some reason.
Cause I wonder if, when I started getting into writing prose as rather than just writing songs, the revelation for me in terms of being able to write was to approach it like poetry, but without telling anybody.
Yeah. <You know. laughs> No, I think obviously the best songwriters, the best lyricists, they. I always am careful about calling out lyrics as poetry because they're part of a musical creation. In a lot of cases, the great lyrics are great poetry for sure.
Yeah. Sometimes they can be. Yeah. Sometimes that's also cultural, isn't it? I mean, I find anyway, like, because for example, in England, you can rhyme, a poem can rhyme and be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. At the same time. And that is just not the case in the US tradition. If it rhymes, it's immediately something funny. I mean, in the minds of many American listeners. So if it rhymes and it's a song, it can be taken seriously again.
Mm-hmm.
But So it's like there's a lot of rhyming poetry in England that people take seriously, which I took a while for me to get used to. It's just a really different way that people hear there.
Yeah. Near the end of his life, my dad started experimenting with rhyme again, experimenting. Just the idea that that's experimental is kind of humorous. But yeah, I think it's great that there are still people who can write a rhyme and get away with it for sure.
Is there, do you think, I mean, I don't know if this is just sort of stereotypical ideas that people have, but do you think that the countryside, the rural parts of the Midwest and tend to produce more writers and poets? Because, I mean, just, I don't know, it just seems like there's a disproportionate number that come out of small towns where there's not much going on. And I don't know if that's just, because there's not much going on, so it encourages people to write, or if it's something about the environment that causes all that writing. I'm thinking of poets like Wendell Berry and, living on that farm out there.
Yep. Yeah. Well, in Iowa, there's a real strong tradition, and the writer's workshop here at the University of Iowa is world famous for producing writers. There's maybe a meditative aspect to the rural life and the isolation that lends itself to writing poetry. I would think that's probably legit, but we all know that there's been plenty of great poetry written in, tenements in Brooklyn as well. I don't know. But the rural life is interesting, and it's becoming an increasingly bizarre. It's becoming as equally bizarre culturally as any city.
Talk about that. What's it like? Before we started broadcasting, you were saying you're kind of on this dividing line between the more progressive parts of Iowa and more sort of the Trump supporter crowd. You said you're not getting out a whole lot during the pandemic, which is true of many people, but I'm sure you're getting out in rural Iowa more than people in Portland are getting out in Iowa. So, what's it like as best as you can tell? What's the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement response been like among the white-bred little sections of Iowa there?
Yeah, it's crazy because, I left Iowa for about 15 years and came back, and those years were during the time of the sort of collapse of the farm economy and the loss of so many family farms and the agribusiness takeover of farming country. So when I left, there was still this really strong populist sort of left-wing aspect to farmers. Farmers were famous for milk strikes and dumping their grain on the lawn of the state capitol and, refusing to, if someone's farm went up for auction, the neighbors would get together and buy it and give it back to them. There was this sort of aspect to life that when I left that had completely disappeared when we returned in 97.
Happened? How did that transformation happen? Because I also have friends who grew up in Iowa in the 1930s who talk about the penny auctions and about mm-hmm. the solidarity among the socialist farmers of Iowa and the cooperatives. And what happened?
Yeah.
The cooperatives still exist.
The grain cooperatives exist.
We have eight minutes left of the show. Now you can explain what happened the past century.
No pressure. one word, Reagan. Earl Butts said, go big or get out. People got overextended financially and people just lost their farms. Now most of the land around here is owned by investors and managed by people who don't live on the land. And the bigger the machines they can get, the better they like it. That combined with farm subsidies and the same kind of, tax dodges that other rich people in other industries take advantage of, it's just taken its toll on this countryside. And, that resentment has sort of really gotten distorted and become this sort of right-wing thing that's going on. We've got it here as much or more so than any place else in the country. Those people who in times past would have looked at the government and said, we're getting screwed, are now looking at they've been convinced that the others around them, that their neighbors are the problem, not the government. And it's this horrible, toxic thing that's happening just like everywhere else in this country, unfortunately. It's still, beautiful Grant Wood painting looking country. There's a lot wrong with what's going on, and it's all about economics, really.
when they talk about in the press, I mean, you know, regularly they talk about economic meltdown, the potential of tens of millions of evictions if the when the moratorium gets lifted, all kinds of really just absolutely, you know, horrendous stuff that would make basically any society, you know, pretty much, you know, as they say, ungovernable. But like they also talk about a civil war. And I just have trouble imagining. I mean, I'm sure I'm maybe just not imaginative enough, but can you imagine there in rural Iowa what, like, if there's a civil war, what do they mean by that? And what would the sides be? I just can't imagine what the sides would be. I mean, there's loads of people with guns, but where are the lines in this civil war?
Yeah, I don't know, because I have neighbors who are, you know, constitutionalists who don't pay their taxes and are very anti-government, and you know, I hang out with them and I always joke, I'm like, I'm so far to the left and you're so far to the right, we sort of almost met on the backside. There are like a few issues that are just totally off limits,
right?
But they're, you know, they're heavily armed. You know, there are a lot of people out here who are, and
but and what kind of stuff can you agree on when you guys talk politics at all? Like with economics, can you agree on economics? And do they dislike the corporate elite as well? Or is it mainly like race and sexuality issues that you can't agree on?
Sexuality issues to a certain point, religious issues, abortion, stuff that's based in their faith. You know, understanding that the government is run by corporations, that the Constitution and these sorts of things are not what's governing us. You know, there's a lot of commonalities in terms of, you know, our sort of political viewpoints. As outsiders, as non-members, non-Democrat or Republican Party members, you know, some of these, I've been surprised. Some of these very small towns have turned out with BLM events of one sort or another, acknowledging what's going on in other parts of the world, even if they have, you know, one or two black people in town. You know, there are still people who are, you know, spreading that message.
Have they been met with lots of counter protesters?
You know, there have been some incidents in Iowa City in particular. Somebody rammed one of the marches with a car. A couple people were slightly injured. But there's, you know, there's definitely there's a cultural divide happening here, and it's severe. But I think it's maybe in a lot of cases, it's the media that's driving both sides to alienate the themselves from the others, you know, when it comes down to it, when the derecho hit, Cedar Rapids, everybody was out there cleaning up everybody else's yards, and there was no looting or revolution or whatever happening there. There were just a bunch of people, you know, driving around town with a pickup and a chainsaw, seeing who they could help out, you know. So,
generally, what happens, including in the big cities, when all the lights go out, everybody's out helping each other out. Where are the riots? Well, they don't generally happen, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, you know, I think when left to their own devices, people can still rise to, you know, to the occasion, for sure.
A nice optimistic note to conclude on.
That was a good accident. Anymore. Yeah. You know, we better end right now before I say something really shitty.
Let's not talk about the bomb shelter.
Yeah.
It was great talking to you, Rich.
Yeah, likewise. It was really fun. I'm really honored to have been a part of this. And thank you for putting this whole series together. you know, I have bundles of Fifth Estate that, you know, would normally have gone out to zine fests and, you know.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. None of those happening. Stuff.
And I, you know, I kind of worried about how Fifth Estate was going to weather this sort of thing. And I mean, obviously you're part of, you know, sort of keeping the dialogue happening. So I was really pleased to be invited to take part. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Gives us all something to do during the pandemic anyway. At least that's how I got started with the broadcasting. But,
no, I love it. I've listened to a lot of the shows. You've done some great stuff.
Thanks. Take care, Rich. I'll see you again.
Yeah.
And thanks, everybody, for tuning in to another episode of Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. London time, 7 p.m. in Copenhagen, the middle of the night in Australia. And I'll be back on the screen here on whatever platform you're watching on, whether it's KBOO Community Radio's Facebook page or Popular Resistance's Facebook page or another platform. I will be back on these same platforms tomorrow. If all goes well, I'll be interviewing Sherry Hankala, one of the founders of Kensington Welfare Rights League in Philadelphia, who has recently been involved with a whole bunch of housing takeovers. And we'll hope to see you tomorrow. And should be having a new album coming out by this weekend on Bandcamp called Say Their Names. More about that later. And I might get into singing a song for you in this show. Peter says I should conclude each show with a song. I might start getting that in the process of events, but I haven't managed to do that for this show because it's logistically overwhelming. But I'll readjust. I'll adjust to that. Need a producer, a local producer in the room here. Okay, take care, everybody. Don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get you through. Don't be afraid of your neighbors. Talk to you soon. Bye for now.